The Red Eye Radio Podcast is a service of Freightliner and Detroit.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
Good morning and welcome. He's Gary McNamara. I'm Eric Harley as we move into a Friday. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Eric. Lots of news out there that we're going to bring your way. 12 GOP senators vote against the president's national emergency. We'll get to that. Now, look, there was a lot of rhetoric on social media yesterday, but we all knew this was going to happen. This was no surprise at all. To me, there was a lot of fake. Oh, can you believe they did? Yeah, I believe they did this. It's no surprise at all. There are constitutional issues here, and the president's going to, you know, portray it one way. And we said the president might have a point, especially with the information that you have seen more illegal immigrants cross the border now in February and over the last 5 months. He might be able to make his argument, but there is actually a legit constitutional issue here, and that is when it comes to a national emergency. There's a lot of gray area here. You know, what is it? And the courts will now get involved because the president, this has been expected. This is not new. It's been expected for weeks. And to me, there was a lot of fake outrage on both sides yesterday, and it was like, We knew this was going to happen, so I don't know what the fake outrage is about.
It's almost as if we're going through the motions.
Yeah,
because there was not going to be another outcome. We knew there was not a veto-proof majority.
And I this is one of those cases where I understand both sides of the issue. Mm-hmm. So is it a betrayal of the president? No, there are senators that honestly believe, and they look at it and they say, no, this is our branch of government. Our branch of government makes these decisions, not yours. Mm-hmm. And the president saying, no, I think this is a case where it truly is a national emergency based on this. Mm-hmm. These things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think both sides, and I'm talking the Republican side, I'm not talking the Democrat side, not the Democrat votes. The Democrats let Obama do anything they want, and all of a sudden are outraged now. Mm-hmm. And you can go down the list of executive orders that he put out. I'm talking about for example, Rand Paul. Now, there may be some senators that just hate the president on the Republican side and would vote against him, but there is actually a legit constitutional issue here as we've gone through it. But I think the president also has a great point. And one of the problems is I don't think Congress, and this is going to happen. I mean, this happens all the time. Congress did not specify. Let me put it this way. There's gray area in the National Emergencies Act from 1976. And this, to me, could be one of those gray areas, even though traditionally this was not something that you would perceive as being a national emergency. Mm-hmm. Because Congress has had the ability to do it. Normally, a national emergency is something that is acute. Now, the president might be able to make that case. Well, it's become acute because of what has happened the last 5 months.
Right.
Those numbers that came out the other day may strengthen the president. I have a feeling that if it comes before the Supreme Court, as we said before, if I was a Supreme Court justice, I would look at this and say, well, if you look at what the national emergencies actually have been, what the precedent of national emergencies have been, I would tend to believe that the president overstepped his bounds. But as a Supreme Court justice, I probably would say, but it's not up to me to make that decision
as to
what the parameters of a national emergency are. You guys work it out.
Well, because here's the way I would look at it. People keep saying it's a constitutional crisis.
No, it's not.
I don't think it is. I think you could easily say, constitutionally speaking, the president is not outside of his bounds. But we, being the judicial branch, are not supposed to be deciding what constitutes. It's not for us to decide what constitutes a national emergency. That's a dangerous area to get into because then we could start setting that ourselves, and we do not act as the commander-in-chief as the president would do.
Right.
And we cannot act as Congress either.
I would defer more and say, look, if the president called this, then you fight against it. Well, we don't have the votes. Well, that's the way the system works. I'm a judge. I didn't set up the system.
And if...
I didn't set it up this way.
Well, the system provides for it. If the makeup were each, the House and the Senate, were overwhelmingly controlled by the Democrats, in this case, let's say, and it was a veto-proof majority, that's the system at work. And Congress has the ability to rescind the National Emergency Declaration. That resolution is in place as a part of the process. They did not get it. And keep in mind, that process was at work up to the last minute as they were trying to decide how many defectors on the right there were going to be, right? Imagine that all of the Republicans came out. I mean, you saw the resolution on the Mueller report. That was an overwhelming vote. That is a huge, huge, again, both parties saying, yes, we want this. If the Republicans had come out and said in the Senate, McConnell and all of them, no, the president is overreaching here, and we agree with our colleagues on the left, and he's overstepped his bounds, and they did the same in the House, it would be done. The process is in place for them to rescind it. The makeup of the Senate is the representation of the people. Same with the House.
And can we stop with this constitutional, purity that we seem to be throwing out, out there? And what I mean is the fact that you have had executive orders passed in the past by both presidents that you could look at and I could look at and I could say, as a constitutional issue, this shouldn't be done. But because it fits where the party is going, executive branch power is always being tested no matter who is in office.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no purity where every time the president oversteps his bounds that the courts come in and clamp it down. Doesn't always happen that way.
No.
Many times it happens where you just have, the president did it. Nobody really cares. Is he overstepping his bounds? Yeah, but Congress really doesn't care. So it isn't stopped. There is no purity in this. It does get to the point of where politics at times with the executive branch can do things that maybe there's an outcry about, but Congress really overwhelmingly doesn't want to stop it. And politics always is involved in support or non-support of a executive order. And so there is a process set up. So you're right. When they say it's a constitutional crisis, it's not. No, this is actually working exactly within the Constitution. And in any human endeavor, there's always going to be gray areas that have to be worked out somehow.
Yeah, because I don't think you can say definitively that the president stepped out of his constitutional bounds here. I actually don't think that's true. The way I see it is that he made a call. And if he is basing that on numbers, we can... Here's the difference, I think, with when you get to the Supreme Court. You can talk about something that is purely political, because that's what the left and some Republicans are saying, that he couldn't get his way politically. He did not get the deal done, and so he's going to go, this direction and use the more heavy-handed direct approach. All right. When you're having a hearing before the Supreme Court and they're listening to this, you might be able to make that case if the president didn't present the numbers that he presented. One of the things that has totally been undersold over the years is what's going on and what the increase of activity across the border actually is and what kind of danger it presents to Americans. We go back to Arizona and then the federal government going after Arizona, talking about how dangerous it is. Forget about even the drugs that come across, we can certainly have our discussion about that. That's not something you should dismiss, but we can look at the other side of it, and that's the business of moving people. That's where the cartels make a ton of money these days. That's where, because they know there are people willing to pay, and then they'll get them across. It's not the trafficking of the drugs so much as it is the people. And that's the big business right now.
Right.
And it's not just Mexico, but Mexico is the doorway for South America and everything else. The point being is that the left has completely undersold, and I think some on the right in the past, undersold what's going on the border. And I may be a bit partial. I have friends at the top of the Border Patrol. I spent significant time down there, but I think that experience, and I'm talking as a layman. I've never worked Border Patrol, but I know full well what the problem is on the border.
Right.
And so the point being, if you're arguing this before the Supreme Court, if the president didn't have those numbers, those statistics, and this was purely a political move, and nothing really had ramped up in recent years or months, then you might be able to make the point it's purely political. But you can't make that argument. You can't. There is something right now, very real, and when the Border Patrol says we need this, that's when you take it out of the political realm altogether.
As we've said, though, there's a difference, though, between an actual emergency and the constitutional definition of an emergency.
Is there a constitutional definition of an emergency?
Yes. When you have Congress not address something over a period of time, where they just whether you believe it's an emergency or not, I can sit there and look and go, I believe it's an emergency going on down the border.
Mm-hmm.
Congress doesn't. They don't do anything for 30 years on it. They don't do it. The president comes in and says, I'm going to do it. Congress says, wait a minute. Well, because of the National Emergencies Act. And they said, well, wait a minute. We haven't acted on this in 30 years. Mm-hmm. There's a challenge. There's a problem. But it doesn't fit the emergency because we as Congress are the body that has not acted in there. And the executive branch exists that if Congress doesn't have the time to address a certain emergency, that's where the president comes in if it's acute. Congress, even though I would agree with everybody, I believe there's an emergency down there at the border.
Mm-hmm.
It's whether Congress is willing to address that. If Congress doesn't address it, if I'm a judge, I look at that and say, well, wait a minute. The Emergency Act was set because the executive branch's power comes from the fact in a wartime or wherever, a natural emergency where Congress doesn't have the time to act. They don't have the time. Congress certainly has had the time to act on the border, and they've chosen not to. And as we've said before, if the elected representatives wish to doom the country and the people keep voting them in, the Constitution allows them to do that. It may be the wrong decision, but the Constitution allows them to do that. Now, saying that, if I'm the judge, I would still look at it and go, but it's not my job to set the parameters of this particular law. Now, it would be if, for example, it was a Democrat president who said, okay, guns are a national emergency, therefore everybody must give up their guns. Well, at that point, you've got a Second Amendment violation that I can clearly define based on Supreme Court precedent.
Yeah, at that point, you've violated the constitutional rights of American citizens.
Yes.
I mean, that's very clear.
So that would, and again, that's why I said this thing is complicated. Everybody wants to make it as simple, well, it's this way or that. Well, it's not. It really isn't. I mean, there are constitutional issues that are involved here, but there's also the separation of powers. If I'm a federal judge saying, okay, maybe he could have overstepped his bounds, but it's not my job to determine it. It's Congress. It's your job. Well, we don't have the votes. Well, then it stays.
Right. Yeah, because
that's a system that you voted up. And if you left it a gray area, I'm not going to define your gray areas for you.
That's my whole point. It really isn't defined. It's not defined at all. And it has to be. And I agree that it should be defined by the people. But here's the difference in this case. If you want to get down to the political argument, You had just years ago the Democrats calling for the same thing. Calling for barriers.
Yeah. Yep.
They wanted barriers. So everybody's screaming about how the president didn't get his way. Well, the president can make the case. If I'm arguing before the court, Your Honor, here are the words. We're going to play you the words of the prominent members of the Democratic, the Democratic Party right here of how they feel about this.
My response as a judge may be, even if I don't get involved eventually, would be saying something is one thing. Legislating it is what I have to go by as a judge.
Exactly.
Which means the actual legislation.
Which, again, gets back to, and my whole point was, everybody says it's purely political for the president. Tell me it's not opposition.
Oh, no, no. Of course it is.
And so that's the whole
point. No, that's a great point. Yes, that's a great
point.
So
we can take that off of the table. They're acting in a purely political way. The question is, can the president, constitutionally, does he have the right to act in this way? He does up until the point you get to the actions themselves. Then it would be, how do you, in order to fulfill what you want to do, your mission here is what? Build the wall. Now it's about eminent domain. I suspect the court's going to look at this and say, the president is not outside of his constitutional bounds here. Because we're not going to get into the business of defining what a national emergency is. He can say it's a national emergency.
Right.
Now, what he's doing and how he's doing it, those details will come to the court already in the lower courts, and we'll decide on each of those steps along the way.
Yeah.
Because I think with eminent domain, they're going to have a problem. All along, that's what I pointed to.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio, 866-90 Red Eye. Also in the news and things we'll be covering, New Zealand police have detained four people after mass shootings in two mosques in the city of Christchurch, New Zealand. Police Commissioner Mike Bush is urging everyone to stay indoors until they're sure all suspects have been apprehended.
The attackers were apprehended by local police staff. There's been some absolute acts of bravery. I'm hugely proud of our police staff, the way they responded to this. But let's not presume that the danger is gone.
He also stated there were a few ports of IED strapped to vehicles, which we were able to secure. He said that's a quote. He said it was not possible to assume that the attack was isolated to that one city, saying at this point in time, we should never make assumptions. New Zealand media have reported that between 9 and 27 people have been killed.
TVNZ also reporting that at least one of the suspects here is an Australian national. They're also reporting about 10 minutes ago that the strict lockdown on Christchurch school has been lifted. So we don't know if they believe it's been contained, but there's a heavy presence in this area by officials, and we'll keep you updated. There are updates coming in on a regular basis. For Travel Centers of America, here's your forecast.
Just a few light lingering snow flurries from Wednesday's massive storm that hit the Front Range of Colorado very hard into Wyoming and portions of Montana. Up and down I-25, things are clearing out. We had over 1,000 stranded motorists on Wednesday. The snow connected with the system is now along the Dakotas and Minnesota border. We'll see rain for mainly Wisconsin and in the Chicagoland area today. That'll extend all the way down toward New Orleans. And there is the likelihood along the front of seeing some intense thunderstorms today, especially in and around northern Ohio, where the low pressure becomes more intense. Tomorrow, things will be winding down from this system, but we will see rain for the mid-Atlantic and portions of New York City into Boston and New England. This late winter system has affected the U.S. from Montana to New Mexico and everyone eastward. There's a look at your national forecast from Red Eye Radio. I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Thanks, John. 866-90-RED-EYE.
The Bonus Show.
And he's Eric Carly. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Also in the news.
That's the way not only to campaign, not only to win the nomination, not only to win the general, but that's the way to govern, is with America. No one person, no one president can meet all these challenges on their own. It's going to take all of us coming together.
Robert Francis O'Rourke, yeah. Officially in. We'll get to that here in just a couple of moments. Other news out there. No surprise report from the TASS news agency in Russia that North Korea considering suspending nuclear talks with the United States. No surprise there. If they decide to do that, the UK votes to delay Brexit, as we sort of predicted the other day. Hallmark Channel severs the ties with the actress over the college admission scam. Ocasio-Cortez's clueless economic moment of the week. And Lindsey Graham calls for a special prosecutor to look at the Obama administration. There's so much to talk about. And yes, I got to make sure I play one of the Democrat candidates who was in, Andrew Yang, who talked about the fact that white people will soon be killing Asian people.
Right. Because they view the situation with China as a new Cold War.
Yes. So it's like, oh, okay, so now we're getting to that point.
Well, let me ask you, Gary.
I was playing that during our pre-show meeting. The look on your face. Well, you turned to me like, what?
I said, okay, based on what?
Yeah, I know.
Based on what? Because you lived through more of the Cold War than I did.
Yes.
You lived through the duck and cover years.
Yes.
I lived through the good luck years. And I don't remember, now, I was a kid, but I don't remember out of fear during that Cold War. I don't remember Americans killing Soviets. I just don't remember that, or people of Russian descent. So I don't know where he gets that from.
No, I don't.
Is there a precedent?
I don't believe that there was any. I don't believe that there was a precedent where anybody. And by the way, remember, at that time also, Red China was huge.
Mm.
People forget about that. It was a Cold War against the Soviet Union, but, right. You know, Red China. I can still remember that the other threat besides, the Soviet Union, as you got into the 60s and the 70s, and they became a nuclear power, it was always the fact that I'll never forget that, well, we're never going to be able to beat the Chinese because they have so many more hundreds of millions of people that we do that if they wish to, and I remember that debate as a child, as a teenager, that was going on. And somebody said, yeah, but they have to get here.
Right.
But I want to play it. I have the audio here now from Andrew Yang, so I want to play it. Who's a Democratic candidate for president of the United States? Here it is.
And who is going to be the boogeyman of the next 10 to 20 years? Who's going to be the great rival to the United States in the eyes of American society? China. That's right. And so what do you think the attitude is going to be over time for the shrinking, insecure white majority that's losing their jobs for, let's say, Chinese Americans or Asian Americans? I said to a group at Harvard, I think we're one generation away from falling into the same camps as the Jews who were attacked in a synagogue in Pittsburgh, just a couple months ago. It's like we're probably one generation away from Americans shooting up a bunch of Asians saying, damn the Chinese because there's a giant Cold War or even more with China. That is the great danger that
We wondered where the Democrats are going to go. When you get to the point of Hitler, then you have to come to the point that, the accusation that the other side will soon be killing us all en masse.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's it. Well, and how long before we're putting the word out? We're putting out a warning to make sure people are safe, because I don't believe they're safe. The fake warnings. That's exactly what that was right there. I mean, he wasn't saying imminent, but he is saying it's on the way. It's not going to happen today, but trust me, it's going to happen.
Well, this goes back to when we have talked about the identity politics of of the left where they are the ones, because it was something, if you've been a long time, you know, listener to this show or really any show, the first accusation from the left to the right is that they're racist.
Right.
Any belief that they have,
right,
they are racist. And, you know, you and I now have been working together almost 14 years, but I've been in talk radio for almost 3 decades and you've been in well over 2 decades. And that has been for such a long time the first accusation on almost any issue that will be thrown at you. And it used to a long time ago, it used to frustrate us. It's like, you know, why is that the first thing out of your mouth? And then we realized that we don't think that way, and we assume everybody else thinks the way that we do. I'm not a racist. You're not a racist. I don't understand why people are racist. I've said this many times. A lot of racism isn't true racism, where you believe that you are genetically superior to someone else, but it's actually based on envy and jealousy. To me, that has been more of my understanding of what the modern racism, if you wish to call it, quote, racism, is today, where people are envious and jealous of other people. But since we're not that way, we always wondered, and it was a serious accusation when it was made to us, why are you saying that we're racist? I mean, what indication, except for the fact that I disagree with you on something? And then we came to the realization that they're the ones who think that way. They're the ones who wish to separate everybody and judge everybody by color. Andrew Yang, generalizing the way whites think. And we had started this a long time ago when you had the liberal black leadership, which is different than the conservative black leadership. The mindset that if you are a conservative black, you're not truly black. That you're betraying your race. That all blacks must think alike, which means all whites must think alike, which then evolves into white privilege. Since you all think alike and you all are alike, you have something that nobody can actually determine what it is, but we're going to call it white privilege, which gives you the advantage. We are always permanent victims. And therefore, we can make whatever accusation we wish against you. What we found out is we're not racist and we don't think that way. We don't judge people by their skin color. We don't judge people by their religion. We don't judge people by their gender. We judge them as individuals with souls. That's how we judge them. And now, we judge them by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. They don't. Everything that they do is judged by skin color, sexuality, gender.
Mm. Well, I would, by the way, just so that I can be totally intellectually honest, I do believe that there could be a risk of Chinese nationals being harassed or attacked if they're wearing MAGA hats.
You may have a point there, sir.
I damn sure do.
That's a great thing.
Based on real things that have happened.
That have actually happened. So it doesn't bother us anymore. Now it doesn't, because maybe it used to a little bit, you know, because it was such a serious accusation. Now we realize, and we've come to realize, once you do this for a while, you realize when people just attack you personally or attack you in that generic way, or the way that, again, an accusation which they can't define, just a label, you realize, as we realize now, we take it completely in the opposite way. It's a compliment. They can't argue the substance of what we're talking about, so they need to attack either personally or they need to attack in an intolerant and racist way because they can't defend their points. And I think that's how most conservatives, because this has been something that's been going on for two or three decades now in the arena of public ideas is if you're on the right and the left thinks one way and you think differently, you're a racist.
Yeah.
And now we've come to realize, well, wait a minute, that just shows that intellectually they can't argue the point anymore. And so I would say that actually the right, because of that accusation, have come to realize that, wait a minute, when the left uses that against us, that's a weakness in their argument. And they're still using it. And they still stereotype. They still have the bigoted, intolerant mindset of stereotyping people by their skin color, by their gender, by their sexuality. And they've expanded it way out into a huge pie of victims and oppressors based on what you are. And if you don't think the same way and you are in a particular demographic, then you are betraying that particular demographic. It's not hard to understand.
Nope.
So Andrew Yang saying that, it's like, okay, you have no substance to your arguments, do you? You can't debate the issues anymore.
Well, he went straight for the direct fear.
Yeah.
And it's a lie.
I'm running because if I don't run, they're going to kill us.
Right.
Well, it's getting, at least it's direct, I'll say that. It's
Yeah, exactly. It went straight. It went straight for the point. It's a lie. And it's one of those lies that is based on nothing. It's one of those lies that you can't disprove because he's trying to say something that's going to happen in the future. See? Not something has happened. And he's one of those that, again, is not going to get the attention that, somebody else is going to get on the stage. So what do you do? You're going to have to go for the big fear. I'm here because the others are saying, I'm here to give you something. He's saying, well, I'm here to protect you from the racists.
As to O'Rourke and all of us coming together, when I played it the first time in our pre-show meeting, Eugene just looked at me. You just said, nobody wants to hear we're all coming together.
Yeah, I was saying that to a friend on yesterday morning when I saw this video, and a friend of mine said, oh boy, here we go. And I said, because you and I talked about this yesterday, I think probably off the air. I'm not sure if we did it on the air. Tell me which side wants to come together. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Everybody says that. We need to come together as a nation. We need to come together. What the Democrats are saying is we need more people like a John McCain or maybe a Mitt Romney or people that cross the aisle. Well, what they mean by that is we need Republicans moving further left. Now, right. They've been getting their wish. We will say that because the party on many things has been moving too far left, in our opinion. But that's what they want. They want people to come to their side. Quit fighting us. Quit trying to debate us. Because we keep losing those debates. We keep distracting from those debates. But tell me who on the far left wants it. Who on the far left? Is Ocasio-Cortez saying everybody needs to come together?
No.
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 Omar, is she saying that? Is she trying to bring people together, Gary?
No, Ocasio-Cortez is giving us her theory of economics that the lender is responsible for what the borrower does with their money.
Right.
That was her economic lesson this week.
Yes. I hope she's never in a car accident and injures someone else. Right? Mm-hmm. The bank should be responsible. Everybody else should be responsible. The maker of the maker of the clothes you're wearing, they should be responsible.
Yeah, you're right.
The tennis shoes.
Part of it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you wouldn't leave the house without your shoes, right? Okay, we're going to blame the tennis shoe maker. Yeah.
I guess the question would be, how far will the stupidity go with her? Because every week is another just.
It really is.
Every week is a gift.
It really is.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio, 866-90-RED-EYE. Welcome and good morning. He is Eric Carley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Coming up on the top of the hour, the Hallmark Channel severs ties with Lori Loughlin, saying, sorry.
Yeah.
You're out of here. We'll have the latest on the New Zealand mosque shooting, anywhere between 9 and 27 killed in those shootings, according to different press around the world.
Right. It happened at two different mosques in the same town in New Zealand. And there have been, as you said, Gary, various reports as to the number of people who died in those shootings. But they do have four suspects in custody right now, and more details on the way.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866, all across the world.
Yeah,
I had one of our listeners in Italy say,
saying
all across America.
So,
you know, you're all across the planet.
Thank you to our global listeners. We do hear from them every once in a while.
All across the world.
We are global.
We are global.
Yes, we are.
That means international.
It does? Oh, man. I should have worn like a button-up shirt or something, not this T-shirt.
And I'm telling you, I've just been dying laughing.
Yeah, what do
you
got?
Were out of the studio a little bit. I wish you were in here when I first saw the headline.
What's that?
Beto is a loser. Uh-huh. And it was written by Piers Morgan.
Oh, wow. Piers is crossing over to the dark side, man. I mean, what's going on with him lately?
I don't know. Was he on MSNBC or CNN? I forget.
CNN.
Okay.
And now he's in the UK.
Yes.
Is it a morning show? I don't know. I think it is. But he has been on how many issues? We know on gun control he hasn't changed.
Right.
But I've always chalked that up to, he's British. We get it. It's why we came over here a few hundred years ago. But On a number of the ideas, he's kind of called the left out in the last year or two since leaving CNN, really.
Well, when you think that this is Piers Morgan, you wonder, and I really wonder whether somebody like Piers Morgan, even though he's British, but isn't indicative of a significant portion of the population, even of America, who maybe are more liberal, but have sort of looked at where the Democrat Party has gone and said, well, they're nuts.
Yeah, they're crazy.
But let me read a couple of sentences here, because it's great. In 2016, he ran against Ted Cruz in Texas and lost. He didn't lose by much, but he still lost. And in the brutal world of U.S. politics, that usually means the last anyone hears from you, this is the last time anybody will hear from you, for the rest of your natural life. There are a few exceptions to the rule. Hillary Clinton, who was a double loser. But today, Beto O'Rourke announced he's running for president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And he did so in a rather unconventional fashion by announcing the end of the world is fast upon us. As U.S. presidential campaign messages go, it at least had the benefit of being uniquely depressing. O'Rourke didn't quite scream, we're all going to die, but he might as well have done so. In direct contrast to Donald Trump's upbeat winning 2016 slogan of Make America Great Again, O'Rourke thinks he can win in 2020 by telling 320 million Americans, are you ready for this? That we're all doomed.
We are.
We face catastrophe and crisis on this planet, he declared, asserting that climate change will unleash massive migrations of tens of hundreds of millions of people from countries that are literally uninhabitable or underwater. He's not even promising to stop it. Life is going to be a lot tougher for the generations that follow us, he said, no matter what we do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That should... Sorry. Well, that should galvanize everyone into a frenzy of optimism and excitement.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was also the small matter of Mr. O'Rourke's staggering hypocrisy on the very issue of climate change.
Yeah.
For his Texas election campaign, he signed up to a no fossil fuel money pledge that he declared he wouldn't line his pockets with big cash donations from oil, gas, or coal barons. Then it later emerged he had accepted $476,000 in such donations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you're going to run for president, you're going to have to raise a lot of money, and he is, at least if you compare it to his Senate bid, you could make the case that he's capable of doing it. I suspect that we won't see the same kind of national energy in terms of dollars going to him because of a couple of things. The Senate bid was more about Ted Cruz than it was him. The hatred for Ted Cruz, and it could have been anybody running, you would have had outside money going to that Democrat. But then when you compare it to the national stage, that is the primary, he's going to have to put his hand out and get money from the same people that might want to give to Kamala Harris or Bernie or to Joe.
The only difference is a belief inside the Democrat Party that he is the one candidate that they believe could flip Texas. And if they could flip Texas, they get the presidency. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be delusional thought, but
I was just reading the Fort Worth Star-Telegram thought of you know, the congressional districts that the left is targeting and everything else. And we keep hearing this. It could turn Texas blue. It could turn Texas blue.
Well, we heard that last time, too.
Of course we did. We've been hearing it for years. Look, we've had Democrats in Texas for a long, long time. But, and we see that in the suburbs, in the areas, in fact, the area we're in, we've seen it turn blue, at least over on the Dallas County side. Pete Sessions lost his seat. And that has to do with what? That has to do with the people moving here from other states for jobs. There's a huge corporate influx and a massive expansion here in North Texas. In Texas in general, but you have companies moving here because it's a low-tax state. And when companies move here, they look for talent and people move here for the jobs. And they often come here from other blue states or from blue states. And so that's going to happen. There's always a change in the demographics. So you will see some of those districts flip, and they could go blue. Let's hold off on saying you turn Texas blue. Now I do think that's their strategy, no doubt. And I also think it's their strategy that, with all due respect to Joaquin Castro, that they believe in Texas, Beto can get more of the Hispanic vote. And if he gets the Hispanic vote, then takes Hispanic votes from Trump. And remember, Trump has actually been surging as of late in terms of support by Hispanic voters.
You saw the first response from the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Robert Francis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I think that's probably how they will refer to him as.
Mm, sure. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, here's the thing.
Here's the thing. Because I thought about this yesterday.
Uh-huh.
If Trump refers to him as Robert Francis, mm-hmm. will that in some bizarro, backwards way, will the left say that the president is racist for doing
yes.
so?
Yeah, they will. Yeah, and here's how they'll justify it.
Please tell me how.
the folks that assigned his friends and neighbors and community that assigned that nickname, that gave him that nickname.
Ah.
You're demeaning them.
Because he identifies as Beto.
Well, that's because they identify him as Beto.
Oh, because...
And you're targeting them, not him.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. All right. That's okay. Some kind of...
Some kind of ethnic identity transference. Yeah. My friends in Del Rio have a nickname for me. I can't say it on the air.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it equates to moron, but I can't be sure. People I've known since the first grade and love dearly. I think it will come down to the bigger prize is beating Trump. It's a stretch right now to say Beto could turn Texas blue. Let's see what happens in the primary first. Let's see who wins in Texas, who wins the primary. He could win Texas if he in the primary.
Well, I look at, and I've always said, after watching Beto go up against Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. he's really pretty clueless.
Well, the left is already calling him out.
You're right. The left's calling him out. But I do think that he is sort of the opposite of Ocasio-Cortez, who is completely ignorant but will say anything. Where she's completely clueless on everything, but will let everybody know on the specifics what she is clueless about. He's clueless, but he talks in massive generalities, where even Slate.com criticized him yesterday, the leftist website, for not only does he not talk in specifics, he doesn't even get to the point of talking in generalities.
Right.
I thought yesterday, by just bringing up climate change, he did talk in some generalities yesterday. So he is getting to the point maybe of talking in generalities, but as they were talking about, he's still on the thing that, well, I don't like to say that I'm a progressive. I don't like to say that I'm a liberal. I don't like to say, because we're all in this together, and it's all about us, and one for all, and all for one, and the three musketeers, and, I mean, it's the other thing, remember when he did the article, was it the Washington Post? Was it the Washington Post where he said, where he was being asked about things about immigration? He said, well, it's not but what I think, it's what the people think. So I want to find out, I'm going to want to go out on this campaign, and if I decide to run, and I want to find out what the people are thinking. What are the people thinking? That's what we need to find out. What are the people thinking? If I know what the people are thinking, then we can all come together. Not really.
Well, that's not how a leader leads.
No.
I'm not saying leaders don't listen. But they don't listen. You have to first set out your agenda on knowing already what the people want. This is the difference, is that the others will tell you they already know what the people want. Now, they may be wrong about that. But the point is, in knowing what your agenda is, you're saying, and you put your agenda out there for the media, you're telling them, you've already listened. What he's saying is, I'm going to play catch up later. I don't know what my agenda is yet because nobody's told me. But when Bernie has a rally, when Trump has a rally, when Kamala Harris comes out and says, I want to represent the people, and the people want this. This is what they want. What they're telling you is they already know what the people want.
Well, Bernie said, you're a college student.
Yeah.
You're a victim of the billionaires.
Right.
He sold that. They like that.
Right. He knew.
The young people like that thing that you are a victim. Nothing is your fault. It's the billionaire's fault. By the way, you're never going to make it in life either. He had that same message to them.
Right, right.
Which means you should get a lot of free stuff.
Right.
They like that message.
So when he decided to run for president, when Kamala Harris started, her campaign bid, they already know. The point is, they don't have to tell you. I've listened to the people. I know where this country is, and this is what we need to do. He's going, I'll get back to you.
Beto O'Rourke, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I'll get back to you.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Tips from J.J. Keller and Associates Incorporated on DOT drug and alcohol testing. Truck drivers involved in certain crashes are required to undergo DOT post-accident tests for the presence of alcohol and/or drugs. Testing is required when the accident involves a fatality, injuries requiring immediate treatment away from the scene as well as a traffic citation for the truck driver, or a towed vehicle when a citation is issued to the truck driver. DOT rules state that as soon as possible following an accident, your employer must test for alcohol and drugs. Drivers must be tested for alcohol within 8 hours and tested for drugs within 32 hours of an accident. Remember, not submitting to a test or not being available for one within the required hours will qualify as a refusal to test, which has the same consequences as a positive test, and your employer must then remove you from the road. This tip was brought to you by J.J. Keller and Associates Incorporated. Visit us at jjkeller.com.
This has been the Meritor Driver Report, brought to you by Pilot Flying J, Shell Rotella, and Meritor Aftermarket. Run with the bull.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio, 866-90 Red Eye. I mean, you make a point. We're just having a discussion here off the air. The show just continues, whether we're on or off the air. But you're right. Beto was that person that gets the menu and just can't make a decision.
Right.
But I did read the one headline. I think it was in Politico. How Beto got out of his funk.
That's going
to
be the problem.
To run. He was in his funk. He didn't know whether to run. He doesn't know where he stands on the issues. I'm going to go and see what the people all think. You can't be wishy-washy. And that's the difference. You can't be wishy-washy when you have a ton of other liberal candidates on the left running as a Democrat.
Right.
You know, when you had Obama run, he was already well-known. Mm-hmm. He was well-known because he spoke at the DNC back in 2004,
right.
The Democratic Convention. Mm-hmm. But then he was the one that first came out against the Iraq War, and that's really what catapulted him to victory. And then it was between him, as we all know, and Hillary at that point. But you didn't have 20 people in.
No, you didn't.
It's a different time.
And you have people who are very clear about what they want to do, and he has nothing. He mentions things like an economic crisis. What economic crisis are you talking about? Because this is anything but an economic crisis. You can talk, because you're on the left, you can talk about climate change. There's a crisis. And when it comes to climate change, I don't know who listens to that still, but you're on the left and you can get away with that because they've been getting away with it for a long time. You can co-opt that as a part of yours. You're not going to be any different in that regard than anybody else on that stage. So when it comes to anything that you're promising, or I guess, let me rephrase that, what are you promising? You're going to have to, and quit saying, we're going to unite people. We're going to bring them. No, no, no. How are you going to do that?
Democrats don't want to hear that.
The far left doesn't want to hear that.
I don't know any Democrat right now that wants to unite with Trump supporters and have some kind of compromise with Donald Trump. Do you?
No.
I don't know one. I can't tell you a voter out there.
They may want to unite their own party.
Right.
they may want to get together and have a town hall with Nancy and Ocasio-Cortez and work things out.
But that's not what he's saying.
No, it is not.
He's not saying we Democrats need to unite.
Well, because the whole thing, you can't just get away with even the hope and change anymore. Obama is so 2008. He's not part of it. He's being called out by the freshman lawmakers. Omar called him out, referred to him as a murderer.
And no outrage from Democrats.
No.
None.
No.
I still That, to me, is such a huge turning point. That was really a benchmark of a turning point.
Right.
As to where the Democrats are right now.
Well, and the problem is going to be it's all going to fall apart on a debate stage for Beto. It will. Skateboarding is not going to get you there.
Did you see that? The Twitter thing?
Mm-mm. What?
On him,
what Twitter thing?
On him that he's not a good skateboarder. It's all these skateboarders talking about him.
Oh,
saying
yeah.
It was a great, it was fantastic. Like, he's not
funny.
Really good.
Yeah.
One oar in the water. Even bribery won't get you on the USC rowing team. Gary and Eric on Red Eye Radio.
And he's Eric Hurley. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Well, that's really interesting. We go from talking in depth on the air and off the air about Beto O'Rourke and where he fits in the Democratic primary. And just like that, we change to having a discussion over the last 7 minutes about who is seated where for the NCAA bracketology.
Because I don't follow college ball clearly at all, except I watch the games. But for me, I watch any of the games are exciting. It's always exciting to watch those games because you know those kids are working really hard to advance, right? I mean, that's the whole point. Is the there is the immediate reward. It's not like early in the season where, okay, we could work some more on this and you know, and we're going to play more games. But during, you know, when you get into the whole March Madness thing, I love watching and hearing the stories of these kids, these students that are playing, you know. And so, to me, that's it. And knowing that you get the victory, you advance. You get that,
well,
that immediate gratification and reward.
How many times do you and I text each other during the day on a weekday about any sports item? Yesterday.
When we were both
watching basketball.
Right. Well, and we I think we've done that during March Madness before, and that's really the only
thing. Exactly. Because March Madness is the only time we ever do it. And
because I have no idea how it all works. I have no idea. I mean, I get the gist of it, but in determining who's going to be in, who's not going to be in, and what are the chances, like you and I were talking about off the air, TCU loss to Kansas State. But does that necessarily mean that they're completely out?
No.
Could they get an at-large bid?
Yes.
So there's some analysis, and it's interesting because TCU, for those that don't know, they actually got stranded because the plane that was coming to get them got stuck in Denver. So the team, after their loss, had to stay there overnight. And so that's kind of a downer itself. You'd want to come home and at least have a day or two. They will be flying out apparently later this morning and getting home. But I'm trying to put my mind I always think about the kids. I always think about the players on the team. You know, what they might be going through. All right, are they hoping for that at-large bid? Are they watching the rest of the games? What are they doing with their time? And because I compared to the recent story about the NBA commissioner talking about the players, some of the NBA players, they're withdrawn and they don't
unhappy. They're lonely.
Unhappy.
Like what?
You know, they're always wearing headphones. They're always on social media. They don't talk to each other.
Charles Barkley went nuts over that. He was like, "What are you talking about?"
It's funny because I saw the I was watching some of it too, and someone saying, "Look, the you know, it's been said by some of the greats that the championships are won on the bus because you have to gel as a team," and so that NBA commissioner story was interesting. We kind of, you know, broke that down as to, you know, it being generational and everything else. Then you move over to college ball, and there's a completely different mentality. There's a number of those kids, most of those kids, won't go on to the NBA. This is not going to be how they make money. It's not going to be their living, but it is probably the pinnacle of their sports career. You know, this is it. They'll be able to tell their kids and their grandkids and, you know, show them replays of the games and things like that. And to me, that's tremendously exciting because it is, you know, those kids working together. I believe competitive sports teaches a great deal, a great number of lessons, and it's just exciting to watch.
I've always, I come from a football and hockey town, but they, you know, basketball is still the sport I still play it at my ancient age.
Yeah, right.
I'm still planning on getting out there and playing again this year. It's the sport that's always been in my blood. Even more than golf, throughout my entire life. Golf is a very, 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 very close second. And then hockey is a very, very close third because I've played all of them. But for me, it's the beauty about college basketball is, and when you get to this time of the year, remember, it's one and done. So in order to get every game is so important to me, and you don't have, you know, you have so many teams out there. Remember, there are over 350 Division I college teams. So in order to be good, a lot of these teams, you got to play team ball. It's right. Not the same one-on-one stuff that you see in the NBA. And so that's what I really love about it. And the fact is I actually have a team that's been good the last couple of years, University of Buffalo, that I think is 16 now in the net rankings, 18 in the Associated Press. They don't have any great players, but they have 9 extremely good players, and they play defense, and they love playing defense. And it's taken them a long way, and they beat Arizona last year. And even if they don't win their tournament, they've got a bid. They're going in. So for me, somebody who used to go to their games when I used to live right around the corner from their arena back in the 90s, and they had this, you know, they got this 7,000-seat arena, and there's 800 people in it. And I used to go all the time. And it was just, you know, I just love basketball, and the arena was right there. The tickets weren't expensive. And now you can't get a seat. I love that. I mean, I love watching a team progress like that and become, you know, as they call it, a mid-major power. They'll never be a Duke, but they've got a lot of people, a lot of sports people, a lot smarter than I, observing a lot more,
that
believe that they're a Final Four team. So just hearing that is really cool from a team that couldn't draw 500, 800 people unless you were giving away seats, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah,
so,
that's a great story.
So, yeah, it's a great story. Nate Oates, who is her coach, is great. The only other thing I've ever really had when it comes to college basketball is, you know, because Syracuse used to be a power. I used to be sort of a Syracuse fan. And Michigan, always been a Michigan, not always, but I've been a Michigan fan the last decade because their coach, John Beilein, I knew him when he was at Canisius in Buffalo. I did Midnight Basketball 1 year for them. I was the announcer for Midnight Basketball for John Beilein and got to know him a little bit. And he's just a great guy. I mean, just a super guy, and he's done great with the program at Michigan. So, and I don't know. I just for me, it's just the one and done and the excitement leading up to it and all the tournaments. Basketball is on, and believe me, it isn't most of the year, but you get into January and February and then March, it just keeps increasing. And then again, tomorrow I'll just wake up. It'll be on 11 as soon as I get up, probably about 10, 11 o'clock. TV goes on and it'll be on all weekend on basketball. I didn't even watch golf yesterday. Okay. I turned to see who was winning. But
oh, okay. You checked in.
Yes, I checked in. So
Beasley? They introduced him there in Western New York.
Yeah, I saw part of the
former Cowboy going to the Buffalo Bills. Yeah, it's funny because did you see what he said? Someone mentioned, I don't know if it was on social media, why would you go to Buffalo? They're not winning. And he says, well, the Cowboys aren't winning either.
Oh.
Yeah, right? Now, according to him, the Patriots also had an offer on the table. But what he said about Buffalo, he said, look, if you look at the quarterback situation, if you watch the film, you can see there is talent, you know, in their quarterback. You know, so they've got a situation where the implication here is what he's saying is they could develop that team.
But with with what Cleveland picked up in free agency, mm-hmm. the headlines I've seen the last couple of days that Cleveland may be the team to dominate over the next decade. My Cleveland Browns friends, they're just going, either they're cheering or they're going, well, I'm a little bit hesitant to believe that.
Right.
Yeah. After right. It's like they could be the dominant New England Patriots for the next decade with all the, you know, with you know, their new quarterback and all the free agents that they picked up.
But
it'll be interesting in the NFL this year. And yeah. the most interesting thing in the NFL will anybody kneel at all? Yeah. I bet you it's gone.
Right.
I bet you it's almost totally dead
and
coming
up
this year.
I think with Beasley, he doesn't need another reason to go to Buffalo. He's got 14 million of them.
Yeah. Is that what was guaranteed?
I don't know if all 14 was guaranteed.
Well, no, because sure. it was 20-something million over,
okay,
20-something million over
was,
4 years. So
right.
I think 14 was guaranteed.
I think the 14 was must have been the guaranteed.
Yeah, you want that guaranteed money.
Yeah.
Because a contract itself means nothing, because if they cut you, you don't get it. But the guaranteed money, that's what.
Look, it was about the offer. Let's be very clear. You know, you look at that. If you get a great offer, you go.
But you know something? He was also angry that the Cowboys weren't throwing to him enough.
Right.
And he knows in Buffalo that has no receivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're putting a rookie quarterback in. We don't got anybody for you to throw to, but make us win.
Yeah.
And now they do. They picked up a couple of free agents, including Beasley, and he knows as a slot receiver, he's going to get a ton of balls thrown to him,
yep,
and that's what he wants to do. He wants to play the look. If I'm gonna do it, I want to be a major part of the offense, is what he said. And he said in Dallas, I was not a major part of the offense, not as much as he wanted to be.
Right, right. So. By the way, I would agree. I didn't watch this last season, but in what I've seen in the clips and everything, he's very capable. And I don't know what the play is there. Honestly,
anyway, they said is he never drops the ball.
Yeah,
and just one more thing I have to say, and then our intense sports segment, the last time you hear a sports segment for another month and a half or two.
We're going to talk fishing next.
Probably you will, though, with the basketball going on. Mm-hmm. My one complaint, this goes back about 20 years ago. My nephew was playing football, and he said, Uncle Gary, you've got to wear the receiver gloves. He said, you just got to wear them. Let's play a little bit. And you will never understand, once you wear those gloves, why any receiver in the NFL ever drops a ball.
Right.
And I put them on. You jump up, regular football, hard football, doesn't matter the temperature. You throw one hand up in the air, next thing you know, there's the ball sticking in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, how do they ever drop it?
Right.
You ever get a chance, wear receiver gloves just for the heck of it, and then you'll be screaming at any wide receiver who ever drops a ball. Until you die, you'll be screaming at every receiver, and you'll actually be saying, I could make that catch.
Right, right.
It's not like they're stick-em, but there's something that makes it stick to the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like glue, because you can separate it, but it's just got this enormous grip where you can actually make catches with one hand and say, I can't believe I made that catch.
Mm.
So
I may use those for when I become a bartender.
The glass come flying down the
exactly. Yeah, but it's going to be a very interesting weekend. This is one of the most exciting weekends of March Madness. I mean, it's all coming together.
Yeah, you're figuring out, and then next weekend will be tremendously exciting because then I always just love, even if I have no stake in the game, mm-hmm. when I see a number 16 go up against a number 1 seed. When it's close, or you see a number 15 that's defeated. I don't think a 16's ever defeated a number 1 yet, but I think a 15's defeated a number 2 seed. When those happen, those are just great. Those are just pure greatness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's living the Hoosiers.
The underdog story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I always love that when that happens. 86, unless it's my team that has a number 2 seed.
Right.
866-90 Red Eye.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90 Red Eye on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Robert Francis O'Rourke announcing he's running for president. Let's go to Glenn in Birmingham, Alabama. Glenn, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi, Glenn.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
So with all these folks, all these Democrats throwing their hat in the ring for the presidential election in 2020, my personal opinion is that it'll kind of help President Trump with his election because they can't seem to get on board with anything. They're so divided. It seems to me like the Democratic Party is going to kind of eat itself alive. And I was wondering what you guys think about it.
Well, that's always the advantage of the incumbent. The incumbent doesn't have to go through that unless the incumbent is challenged.
Yeah, the other side is divided. And I think there is always something to that, which then you get to eventually as they compete to be the most liberal, each of them, then the moderate being Joe ends up being the nominee.
Well, I look at it by not the fact that they eat each other up, but the fact is in a Democrat primary, specifically this one, and you and I've talked about it. The key is who hates Trump the most and who is the most radical.
Right.
That's I think, the danger that every Democrat candidate right now faces, maybe except a Biden.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'd be interesting to see when he decides to get in.
Yeah, right. I most believe it's going to be in the next couple of weeks. And I think they were probably waiting, and they knew, because it wasn't surprising that Beto announced. Everybody knew it was going to happen. It was just a matter of when, and they probably are waiting for that right moment. I think Joe lets this kind of, you know, all this coverage with Beto kind of pass on, and then a couple of weeks down the road, 2-3 weeks down the road, he'll announce.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Thanks so much for being here this morning. Wow. Ocasio-Cortez is a gift. She's a gift to... And by the way, Republicans will find a way to blow this gift. Mm-hmm. But she is just a... She's a gift to Republicans out there. So is O'Rourke coming out and stating yesterday that he'd be okay with the wall... You know, coming down. He was asked specifically about, you know, El Paso. Would you be okay with the walls coming down? Absolutely. Tearing it down. As we've said, the president should take that and continue, as we said, outside of what's going on right now. But the president should continue and Republicans to continue to market the fact this is how you know the Democrats are for open borders. Mm. These are Democrats that wish to do that. And this is they are the growing influence, as we know. They lost a little bit of power with the deal that the Democrats made, because even getting 55 miles of wall is completely what they're against, because they're actually for open borders. And the president should make that clear over and over and over and over again. Plus, Ocasio-Cortez and, you know, celebrating the whole thing with Amazon, and she's going to be and you said it, she defeated Amazon.
Yep.
She defeated the richest man in the world.
Yep.
She won.
Yep.
We won. We're able to defeat.
Yep. Forget about getting Jeff Flake at the elevator during the whole Kavanaugh thing, and that being empowering to the activist left. Well, she's an activist lawmaker, and she defeated Amazon in her district. That's not a small thing. I think I don't know that anyone in the media focused on it the way that I saw it, because she was celebrating that, of course, that Amazon will not be here. They're not going to get billions of dollars of taxpayer money to come here and create jobs. And when you see that, because keep in mind, this was not a legal case yet. Amazon made the decision. But Amazon made the decision based on the political environment. She was probably the most vocal person on the national scale. The people in that area in New York could probably, you know, to give us a bunch of names of locals who were much more active. Locally, I don't know. But on the when we're talking about the leaders of the Democratic Party, people who have been elevated to a position of power, this puts her right up there in terms of the activist politician. This gives her a great deal of power because she defeated them with that kind of activist behavior. That's the way it will be played out. Like it or not, you can disagree all day long, but this elevates her within the party, and I don't know how the party itself feels about it. That's my question. Because remember the rumor a couple of weeks ago, Gary, that there was going to be, you know, people within the DNC. Again, it was a rumor, but people within the DNC were going to try and issue a challenger, trying to put up a challenger for her in that district, and the whole thing, in other words, try and get her out of power within the party. I think it's very clear that there are some that really aren't on board with the whole Ocasio-Cortez activist left political agenda. There are plenty of them. In fact, her colleague in the Senate is upset that they're actually going to vote on their resolution that he introduced in the Senate. But they're, you know, because they know that members of their own party don't support their whole agenda. They know that it's going to look bad for them. Well, when it comes to this kind of power, again, you know, it's much bigger than the getting the Jeff Flake in the elevator thing on Kavanaugh. It is something that where she has slayed the big evil capitalist dragon. Welcome to liberalism, Jeff Bezos.
You know, this isn't again. I don't know the specifics of the actual deal here. Mm-hmm. I have been critical in the past as a local talk show host when local development agencies have given tax abatements or tax breaks to companies, and you know going in that it's a bad deal that you have made.
Right.
That the jobs that are promised never come to fruition. And what you're doing, if you're a local, if you're part of an economic development agency, what you're supposed to be doing with the cooperation of the local government is bringing in companies because you wish to expand the tax base.
Right.
You're only giving the tax abatements so you expand the tax base, which you bring in 1,000 workers and you realize, okay, we give them a property tax abatement because if they bring in 3,000 or 4,000 jobs, you know, I'm just throwing this out hypothetically, a hypothetical argument, or if they bring in 500 jobs and we give them that, if the majority of those people live in this particular town, they will buy homes, and I'm sure there's algorithms that can figure it out how many people will buy homes, what property tax that they will be buying, if new homes will be built, you know, because of it, the money that will be spent in your town, the sales tax. And again, it all comes down to that. But the whole thing of doing it, you're not just doing it as a economic development agency. You shouldn't be doing it just to bring a company in and say, okay, we've got them here. Not like they do sports teams.
They're right.
You're doing it because your whole goal is to expand the tax base. That would be the actual goal of an economic development agency working with a local government to do so. And so again, you can look at the $3 billion here, and you could tear it apart any way that you want, and say, well, part of it might have been a bad deal, part of it was a good deal. I haven't done the numbers myself. When you talk about 25,000 jobs. Mm. I mean, that's a ton of jobs, even for a place like New York City. And they talk about the fact that a ton of them were very, very, you know, good paying jobs.
Right.
The thing I found interesting was Wall Street Journal: Amazon escapes from New York. $3 billion in subsidies couldn't overcome the hostility to business. And they write here, they go, the Seattle-based retailer had only kind words for Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio, who wooed it like contestants on The Bachelor.
Right.
In return for the promise of 25,000 jobs, the state and city in November offered up to $3 billion in subsidies, as well as a helipad for the CEO Jeff Bezos and other executives to fly over congested city streets. But the ensuing gang beating offered a portrait of what Amazon was walking into. An Amazon executive was asked at the city council meeting last month whether the company would agree to unionization. We have great paying jobs and we respect an employee's right to choose or not to join a union. The executive explained the goal that you are trying to achieve is good jobs, not low paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. de Blasio's response, we're a union town. There is going to be tremendous pressure on Amazon to allow unionization, and I will be one of the people bringing the pressure. I believe that ultimately the pressure will win the day. This followed Mr. de Blasio's recent declaration that there was too much money in the city in the wrong hands. Mr. Cuomo blamed hostile state Senate Democrats for driving off Amazon and insisted the state's fundamentals will continue to attract world-class business. If that's so, why did New York politicians spend $10 billion last year, more than any other state, on business incentives? Republican states also compete with subsidies, but progressives have to offer more to compensate for their oppressive business climate. So, just interesting. I mean, I love the stage it was set a couple of years ago when, remember, it was a contest. You were drooling. And if you lost out on it, well, you're going to lose out. And now we're down to 20. Now we've got 50. Now we've got 20. Now we've got 10. And the excitement was building and everybody was celebrating as if they were going to get the Olympics and lose money. And finally you get the big winner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple of months later, we're gone.
We're gone.
We're glad you're gone.
And they said they're not going to renew the search. They're not going to renew the search at all. Right. They're not. They don't know. Well, or nobody knows. Seems to know what they're going to do, if anything. But they basically.
Well, let me ask this: do they finally realize it was a dumb thing to do?
The national search.
You know,
contest?
This whole national contest probably. Thing that just go in and deal with. You know, with cities,
locals. I
know. Aren't they supposed to use Alliance Airport here, which is a cargo airport? Aren't they going to build a big distribution center there too?
They're expanding their distribution centers here.
I mean,
we have one just a few miles from here.
I wouldn't be surprised if you saw. Maybe not in Florida, but you look at Texas, how we're, it's centrally located.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, people ask about Texas, for example, and yeah, it's a great business climate to be in, but it's also centrally located. It's great if you're an executive.
Because
you can fly to both coasts.
Yeah, within a few hours.
I know because I used to fly. I won't fly as much to the West Coast anymore. Mm-hmm. But when I first moved here, the first 5 or 6 years, it was great.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
because it's not a, you can go to the East Coast, West Coast.
Just a few hours each way. Yeah.
Right. It's real easy to do so. So, I wouldn't be surprised to see in Austin or San Antonio or even in Dallas, the Dallas, North Texas area. Pulling a ton of business.
Well, and that's,
from Amazon.
So. Yeah, there and because there's many corporations that have come here to our area. I mean, within as the crow flies, probably a radius of 10 miles of our studios here, just a number of huge corporations. Toyota, a little further than 10 miles, but came here.
It's like a city.
A couple of years ago. Yeah, their campus
it's
is massive.
It's a city.
Right.
I hadn't been up there in about 3 years, and
right.
I drove up. This was 2 years ago, or mm-hmm. year and a half ago. I drove by.
Right.
I'm driving up. I'm like, what is this?
Right.
I go, where did the city come from?
Yeah. No, it's huge. And so you look at that. It's quite possible that the local leaders saw that as, okay, look, it's a net loss for us because of the, and we don't know. You and I have not done the numbers here.
No.
But it's quite possible that you could have the local leaders there saying it's a net loss, but it's a crown jewel in that we can tell other corporations, look, Amazon chose us, right? And then that attracts other business to come in. They're not going to get the same deals, but you make up for it on the other end. I have no idea whether it was a good deal or a bad deal. 25,000 jobs, if they indeed were high-paying jobs, would be a big deal for any community, even
right.
a New York City. So, but all is for naught because the
you know, it's over. It's not going to happen. And they're going to expand certain centers that they have now. And I don't know if they do anything, actually. I don't know if they make a move at all in the next 5 years if they look at it and say, you know what? Maybe this entire investment wasn't a good idea to begin with, because now they're not going to think about it. Because they started the national search, that brought all the attention. That was positive attention until liberals get hold of it. Nothing can be positive. We can't have anything positive in today's political environment. Now that they have done that and they backed out of New York, the media is just waiting for them to make a move.
Well, that's right. The next place you're going to be examined just like you were in New York.
Exactly.
So, we're not going to do a search.
Maybe you just expand what you already have.
Right. Ocasio-Cortez, today was a day a group of dedicated everyday New Yorkers and their neighbors defeated Amazon's corporate greed, its worker exploitation, and the power of the richest man in the world. Ocasio-Cortez said she is now the darling of the liberals and the socialists. And when I first heard that today, and I heard it on the radio, I heard the statement, and I burst out laughing, and I thought to myself, yeah, they're a big corporation. What are they? A delivery service.
Yes. Well, I've always said, for a long time, I've said, Jeff Bezos is the world's greatest concierge.
Yes,
what do you need? You need toilet paper? I'll bring it to your door.
Right.
What do you want? You want to watch a movie? Okay, I'll get that for you. I mean, he's a concierge. That's what it is. In terms of products that they make, they have, you know, some of the Amazon Basics products, but for the most part, they're a delivery service. That's what they are, logistics. But, again, you don't have to. And by the way, politically, this is a win for Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes, it is.
She got her way politically.
Yep, she did. Yep.
Her constituents
this raises
agree with her, and she is now elevated to a much different situation in locally her district, defeating a massive global company like Amazon. That's not a small thing.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carly, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. The president, and later on today, from what we know, he plans on signing the budget border deal. We head back to you. A lot of people want to comment on it. Let's go to Todd in Indiana. Todd, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Hey, I just want to bring up points. Like you say, everybody's got an opinion, but here's the problem. The problem is that since 1976, over 30 times the emergency has been enacted. And the way to solve that is, and nobody said nothing when other past presidents like Clinton, Obama's used it. And if Congress does not feel it's an emergency, it's already built in the law, which they passed in 1976, is to say what? Hey, by an overwhelming majority, we do not agree with you, and then it's taken off the table. It's already decided. It don't have to go to the courts. That's the way the law was written.
Oh, yeah. And we just got somebody emailed us with the same point. It's a legit point that the courts could look at it and say, well, wait a minute. The Congress gave, you know, set down the parameters, and then Congress also gave themselves the ability to reject any national emergency that a president calls.
Correct.
And therefore, it
Correct.
Doesn't need to be in the courts. Mm. But the fact is, it is going to be in the courts.
When there is a court challenge issued, when someone sues the administration, whether it's Speaker Pelosi or any attorney general from a state, that's going to go to the
Speaker Pelosi. Any attorney general from a state of a private citizen who says you're not going to do eminent domain on my land based on a national emergency when it isn't. So again, go ahead.
No, I would just bring up one point. How come nobody else ever sued any other president? It's because it's Trump. Let's just be honest with you.
We've been saying that all along. This whole thing has nothing to do with money or a wall. It's about Donald Trump.
Right.
Yeah.
That, yeah. But Todd, that's a that may be a moral point. It's not a legal point.
No, it is not.
That's,
thank you,
that's
Todd.
The problem.
We appreciate
I mean, you,
it. Yeah,
I agree with you on that.
Well,
but
and they can't, and the court can't say, well, you know, that I mean, you don't set a precedent by something that didn't happen, that never happened. You would have to ask those along the way.
Constructionist originalists don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. The fantasy from the other side might well paint a different scenario. Valid point, Justice McNamara. Here is your national forecast.
In these overnight hours, we're going to be watching some winter weather advance from the west toward the east, affecting the states of Montana, especially eastern Montana, western South Dakota, Nebraska, and northern Oklahoma. For that area just around I-70 from Kansas City to the Colorado border throughout the state of Kansas, look for the potential for some icing up through Montana. Look for that system to be mainly all snow, affecting portions of I-80 throughout the state of Nebraska. This is all attributed to another large pool of Arctic air making its way southward. For Dallas, today's high will be 74, but by Sunday, the high just 57. So that cold air advancing southward for the next several days. Look for rain on the PA Turnpike around Altoona to Pittsburgh. Lake effect snow from Cleveland to Buffalo. Rains will continue on the West Coast from the midpoint of the Golden State through Seattle. There's a look at your national forecast from Red Eye Radio. I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Thanks so much, John. 866-90-RED-EYE.
Bonus show.
And he's Eric Carley. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Coming up on the top of the hour, we'll talk about Andrew McCabe's new book.
Yeah.
Wow. You know the amazing thing about it? He's almost like, and I think you mentioned this in the pre-show meeting.
Yeah.
The arrogance. It's almost as if they're when they're out there telling you what they're doing, they're doing it with pride as if they were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Until you get down to the actual substance of it and you realize, and you know that we you know, look, everybody uses rhetoric, but we don't use over-the-top rhetoric. But after seeing the text of what he said, I looked at you and I said, look, we don't use language like this.
Mm-mm.
But what was going on in the FBI was as close as I've ever seen in the United States government in my lifetime to people thinking about a coup.
Yeah. I mean, really, it was. And the way that the common thread in the attitude and the words that he used, his demeanor as he spoke in the interview, and again, the language as you're reading kind of through the text of the parts of the interview, which the full interview will air this weekend. When you look at that, it is the same. The common thread is that arrogance that you saw with Strzok when he was testifying, with the former director, James Comey, when he was testifying and when he was on tour for his book. And what was interesting with the Comey thing is, remember, the energy kind of depleted. There were a number of things there where he really didn't see why it was so bad. And I'm reading through some of the transcripts and the stories on the McCabe 60 Minutes interview with Scott Pelley, and I'm thinking to myself, well, he's almost bragging. We go back to Evelyn Farkas. Remember when Evelyn Farkas was on the news and on a program, and she was bragging.
From the Pentagon.
Yeah, from the Pentagon, and talking about how they wanted to get this information to the Hill, their friends on the Hill, so that the incoming administration couldn't squash it, right? And that they wanted to make sure as many people knew about this. And she, the way she was talking, the energy behind what she was talking was like bragging about what she was doing. And I told you, I said, you know, I don't know that she realizes what she's done here. She may not have been in on if there was any, you know, let's say grand conspiracy or whatever at that time. We didn't know a lot of things. We've learned a lot since then. But I said, I wonder whether she's involved directly or not, if she realizes what she has done in throwing her side under the proverbial bus here. Because what you have is a group of activists at very high levels in the Justice Department. Remember, he was the acting FBI director, McCabe, after Comey was fired. Peter Strzok, the former director, James Comey. All of these individuals who were well aware that the dossier had been told, according to testimony from others, that the dossier, the information in the dossier was unconfirmed and could be bogus.
Right.
And all that they knew, yet on the 60 Minutes interview, it really told a lot about what the concerns of the deep state were and maybe still are.
Well, let me just, Washington Examiner did an article on this. There are new revelations about what took place in Washington during the extraordinary period from May 9th, 2017, when President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, to May 17th, when the Trump-Russia Special Counsel Robert Mueller was appointed. The short version is this. The reports were true. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein really did discuss wearing a wire to secretly record the president. Rosenstein and others did discuss invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office, and the FBI did adopt an aggressive new investigative strategy targeting the president himself almost instantly after the Comey firing. If it's all true, that is, if revelations in the upcoming book by former FBI Director Andrew McCabe are accurate, the bottom line on that is this. At least from what we now know, McCabe's story seems to be consistent with information congressional investigators have been able to glean elsewhere.
Right.
It's like we thought all along, said one House Republican hearing the news. If McCabe's account is true, it confirms what we thought about Rod Rosenstein, that he was serious when he talked about wearing a wire and invoking the 25th Amendment. Rosenstein should be under oath. Answering our questions, we need to know who was in that room and what was said. This is about getting the president's cabinet to remove him as president. And it gets down to this. Everything gets down. Forget about the politics, because it's being portrayed. See, they were serious because the president had done wrong. Where's the evidence? What was the evidence? Right. The only evidence that existed was the dossier, which was, again, the Democrats colluding with the Russians. And then by that time of May of 2017, everybody who was in that room knew that it was unverified. And at that time, Comey had already stated he thought there was no credibility to the dossier. So whatever evidence did they have to be sitting in a room discussing removing the president from office?
Right.
What was the evidence? If there was evidence, we'd all know it today. That was almost 2 years ago.
Right. Look, what you have here is, I think, very clear. If you add all the other, and I think the point by the Washington Examiner is really kind of what hits home. Based on what we now know, all combined, the McCabe thing, even Chris Cillizza, I had to give him partial credit over there at CNN, talking about that with the McCabe interview. What you learned, if you're a pro-Trump, if you're a Trump supporter, what you learned really was kind of confirmation of what you already knew. But it to me, it is, you need these individuals to go on record. And not only is he going on record, he's promoting it as if he's proud of this kind of behavior.
Well, but here's the point. He's promoting it as if they did the right thing.
Exactly. They were the heroes.
And the only reason that you're doing the right thing, if you're talking about using the 25th Amendment to remove the president of the United States, is that you have evidence that he colluded with the Russians to hack the election, and you didn't have evidence, and you knew that the evidence, the opposition research that you had, you knew that it was opposition research, you knew it was paid for by the Hillary campaign and the DNC, you knew Christopher Steele wanted more than anything to see President Trump not become president of the United States, and you knew that the information that you had was not intelligence,
It was propaganda that came from the Russians. You knew all of that. Where was the evidence?
Right.
It almost as if they're saying, look, we didn't like Trump. He fired Comey. We just thought that he seemed sleazy, and so we wanted to do, we wanted to see if we could get rid of him. So we had the discussions to see if we could get rid of the president. Right. Based on what? You know, and Chris Eliza, when you were talking about what he wrote, that Democrats heard what they wanted to hear and the Republicans heard what they want to hear. Well, what did Democrats hear that they wanted to hear? The only thing you could hear if you were a Democrat is that we did this because we had the evidence that the president colluded with the Russians to hack the election. Right?
Right.
Other than that, you've got nothing.
There's nothing.
You can fire the FBI director. You knew the unless there was, he would have said, here's the point. Wouldn't you have said if you went on 60 Minutes, we had this evidence, and therefore, oh, we thought the president. What do you mean you thought the president? Based on what?
Based on what?
What? You just can't think that the president has you cannot just say, we believe the president should be removed from office because we were suspicious of him because he fired our boss.
Right. Well, see, this is the other part of the Chris Eliza report on this whole thing where he goes off on, if you are a Trump opponent, this news from McCabe is confirmation that senior officials within the Justice Department were so worried about Trump's behavior in office that they broached the unthinkable removal by means of the Constitution. That sentence right there assigns credibility necessarily to McCabe, to Strzok, to anybody else that was a part of that with still zero justification.
Because the only behavior was firing Comey.
That's right.
You had no evidence that Trump colluded with the Russians to hack the election. The evidence that you thought you had, that you gave to the FISA court, was bogus.
Right.
You knew it, and you knew it back then. You knew it back then. Comey knew it back then. Comey testified in May of 17, or it was in, I don't know precisely when it was, but he testified in 17 that he never knew that it was credible. They never knew it was credible.
Right.
And you're talking about removing the president from office when you don't even know if the information that you have is truthful?
Right.
My God. Like I said, we don't use words like coup often. But the fact that when you see the attitude, when you see, and I think you make a great point, when you see Peter Strzok, how indignant he was, when you see Comey, when you see McCabe, think about this. Think about, these are bureaucrats who believe and think they run the damn place.
Yes.
That they're the elected representatives.
Right.
That they're the arbiters of how the country should be run and the arbiters of whether a president should stay in office or not. Because who in the hell discusses removing the president from office unless you have got slam dunk evidence that he has done something, especially when you're with the FBI.
And we haven't even started to talk about the political affiliation of McCabe's wife.
Let me just finish here. Is McCabe coming out with this? Are they going to start coming out with stuff that they believe Trump will come out with, that's in the, that is the emails back and forth, the whole thing with the FISA warrant and the FISA application and everything else? Are they trying to come out with it first to lessen
it,
the blow?
To spin it to say right, we were really worried. Right. See, we were, because that's the point that Chris Eliza, and I think he fails at that point, tries to make.
We failed.
They
miserably.
Were so concerned. He's assigning credibility to them and their actions. When if you look at their actions aside from McCabe's interview and what he describes, shows the political motivation
right
at work inside the Justice Department to get rid of a guy that they were opposed to before he became president.
The only thing that gives them credibility, the only thing that would give them, not gives them, I don't want to make, the only thing that would give them credibility is evidence. Not their concern.
Right, right.
Their concern means nothing.
If they could say, look, we know this crime was committed.
Right.
We know this happened, or this conspiracy happened to commit a crime. We know this for sure.
Well, here's the point. I'll say this again because to emphasize it. They're FBI agents.
That's right.
They're FBI. They only work on evidence.
Right.
Not conjecture.
Nope.
Not suspicion.
Not demeanor.
Not rumors. Not demeanor. Not language.
Not tweets.
Not tweets. Evidence that a crime has been committed, and they didn't have any. So the fact that they were concerned does not give credibility to those Trump critics out there. It gives no credibility. Only evidence does.
Well, and it completely destroys any credibility, if they had any at all, of a McCabe saying that, you know, he was concerned, because that's what, when he started, he says after Director Comey was fired, he's the one that launched the obstruction investigation, because he was afraid that if anybody came in, his new boss, a new director came in, they would have to go out of the way, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, they would have to do a lot of work to destroy the work he's doing on the obstruction case and make the entire case go away, right? So, in other words, it's almost like the Evelyn Farkas thing. We want to get to it, all of our friends on the Hill, to make sure the incoming administration couldn't squash it. That's basically what he was saying there in that interview that you're going to see on 60 Minutes on Sunday, is that I wanted to make sure that whoever was, you know, going to be the new director would be in place before they got in there. Well, based on what? Based on what?
Well, what I want to see is, yeah. Well,
the president had the legal ability and power to fire the director of the FBI.
Well, they asked that question on 60 Minutes.
Right.
Because that's the only question.
The law broken?
But the only question that you should be asking is, what's your evidence?
Right.
What did you base? If you're talking about removing the president, what was the evidence of wrongdoing?
Right. Did somebody destroy files?
Right.
And
if they say the dossier, but you knew the dossier was fake by that time.
Right, right.
You knew it was fake.
Where's the evidence on obstruction? Aside from the firing of Comey, and that's not evidence because that was legal.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Yeah, I'm watching, you know, parts of it and reading it yesterday and just watching, the clips of it, and I'm thinking to myself, what arrogance. You know what you're saying to the American public? Do you actually know what you're saying?
And that's the thing, is that he may be a hero like Strzok was with the far-left liberals who want them to be activists, but what I don't think they realize politically what they're doing to the left. To the Democratic Party. This is proof that they're willing to be activists regardless of their role, whether they're supposed to be a journalist,
law enforcement,
or someone at a very high level in the Justice Department. They don't care.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.